Walking in the sand, walking hand in hand. The night was so exciting, smile was so inviting. Then he touched my cheek with his fingertips.
Thank you. Welcome to another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's regular podcast about significant developments in upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Mike Eckel, senior correspondent here in Prague, filling in for our regular host, Steve Gutterman. 1993, February, St. Petersburg. Russian authorities announced the seizure of over a metric ton, more than $100 million, of cocaine. The cocaine was stashed in cans of corned beef that was shipped from Colombia and smuggled into Russia by road via Finland. The man whose agents seized the drugs was Viktor Cherkesov, known during Soviet times as a merciless KGB investigator. He was also a confidant of another KGB alumnus, who at the time was St. Petersburg's deputy mayor and the man overseeing the city's foreign affairs. That's Vladimir Putin. Cherkesov, who headed the Russian drug agency, promised high-profile criminal trials into the coke bust. Nothing ever happened. Cherkesov's office halted the investigation 7 months later, saying merely that the main suspects had fled the country. The cocaine itself disappeared from view. A new investigation by RFERL has uncovered multiple links between individuals implicated in the drug smuggling and the St. Petersburg mayor's office, where Putin worked. The findings echo past allegations that Putin himself was involved in the drug smuggling. It's all a very interesting asterisk in the political trajectory of Putin. And join me now to discuss the RFERL investigation are two of its authors. That would be Andrei Soshnikov, an investigative correspondent with Current Time, and Carl Schreck, RFERL's enterprise editor. Здорово, мужики. Добро пожаловать.
Здравствуй, Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hello, everyone.
Great. So thanks for joining me, guys. And again, the new investigation, which you can find in Russian and in English on our websites, is in fact the first in a series of upcoming articles looking into the backstory of Putin's rise to power. If you want to understand what Putinism is, and you want to understand why what Russia is today, why Russia is what it is today, the oligarchs, the Siloviki, capital flight, offshore banks, sanctions, all of it, you have to first take a look at St. Petersburg, Putin's hometown, and where he first made the transition into politics. Andrei, tell us, what is the main takeaway of this first chapter of the investigation?
Thank you. I'll say it again. It was February 1993, quite a depressing time for Russia, to say at least. A ton of cocaine had been intercepted at the Russo-Finnish border. Cargo from Colombia that was delivered by the ship and passed the Finnish customs unnoticed as quote unquote cans of Colombian stew. And according to the head of the local KGB branch, who was Putin's one of the closest ally, Viktor Cherkesov, Russian customs officers noticed that some cans did not have markings, and upon opening them, they found the cocaine inside. And the route had been tracked by authorities in multiple countries, including Israel. And Israel is the only country that convicted some of the people who were behind this operation. They were citizens of Israel. And we've interviewed two people directly linked to this Israel investigation. This was the first interview of the actual person who was convicted for his role in this operation, and the first interview of a witness of this operation that was questioned by Israeli investigators. We've also found some Israeli investigative records, Russian police documents that was that were never observed before, and also you can check in our story, on our landing page, a very unique video and newspaper archives that were never published before. So the Israeli convict says that the paperwork he carried for the cocaine consignment listed a recipient as the St. Petersburg government's public health watchdog, which was under control of the mayor's office. And Putin knew that cocaine will be delivered to St. Petersburg, and he knew that there was a big-scale operation by Interpol to deliver it to Europe and to catch criminals in Europe. But something happened, and Russian police decided to act and captured the cargo itself. Our witness told us that the Israeli businessmen, who were one of the main guys in this operation, had met with, first of all, Putin's boss, Anatoly Sobchak, and another criminal had met with some mysterious person who was intermediate between Sobchak and criminals and worked for the mayor's office. And he used pseudonym and we didn't find this person, but anyway, it worth noticing. And the only person who was arrested by the Russian police in Russia with connection to this case and spent half a year in prison but wasn't convicted is nowadays a famous football agent who worked with several football, or you can say soccer, stars. He's not a criminal anymore, but nobody knew these details about his past. So these are our main points, our main takeaway of this investigation.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. I encourage everyone, if you haven't already, to check out the investigations published in English and in Russian on our websites. And a correction, I guess, in my introduction, I said Cherkasov was the head of the Russian Drug Control Agency. At the time, he later became the head of the Russian Drug Control Agency. But he was still all along a confidant of the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, Vladimir Putin. So, Carl, let's step back and look at the larger significance for a moment of Putin's time in St. Petersburg. Can we draw a direct line from his time as deputy mayor in Petersburg, where this case was one of several scandals, to Russia's political situation today?
Thanks, Mike. Well, I would say one thing you really have to look at, and Andrei is a native of St. Petersburg, so he probably knows this better than I, but I think the complete dominance of organized crime, particularly in St. Petersburg at the time when Putin launched his basically entered into politics, in the mayor's office. I think that was really formative for how he understood, the relationship between between the state and the electorate. I think it really we see echoes of that in the way Russia's run under under Putin now. And, I'm thinking specifically of, cronyism, patronage, the use of law enforcement authorities for the enrichment of insiders. I mean, if we just look at the people who have become incredibly wealthy, the number of Putin friends and insiders who've become enormously wealthy, due in large part to connections to the state cash cow, is really remarkable. And so I think while it was a much smaller scale in St. Petersburg, you see a lot of the same motifs in Russia today and under Putin's reign. In this particular case, in the cocaine case, what's quite interesting as well is I think this still this idea that the state doesn't owe any sort of accountability to the electorate. I mean, when Putin's confidant Viktor Cherkasov, when his team sees this metric ton of cocaine, in the beginning there was a big press conference and promises there'd be a trial. They said they would use the cocaine for medical purposes. It would be repurposed for medical use. And there were regular reports in the police, in the papers about the course of the investigation. And then after that, after these promises that this metric ton of cocaine would be repurposed for medical use, it just completely dropped off the radar. And this was, you know, for me, probably the biggest red flag in the whole story. There was never any, you know, we could never find a single press release or press conference saying, hey, look, we've used all this cocaine to repurpose it for medical use and make all this money for the state. I mean, technically, that that metric ton of cocaine was in the hands of the Russian taxpayer. And what happened to it, we have absolutely no idea.
Yeah. So one chapter of Putin's time in St. Petersburg that has been under scrutiny, examined closely in the past, and keeps coming up as a recurring theme is the question of food supplies. Because back after the Soviet collapse, St. Petersburg faced food shortages, and City Hall made various arrangements to try and fill the gap and, you know, keep its residents from starving. And those arrangements included barter deals where these fly-by-night firms, these fly-by-night companies, pocketed millions of dollars, despite the fact that no food shipments were, in fact, delivered in exchange. Andre, as Carl said, you're a native of St. Petersburg. Talk to us a little bit about the whole food barter arrangement that was also noteworthy during Putin's time in St. Petersburg politics.
I agree. First of all, I agree with Carl that the main term that you can associate with Putin's regime is impunity. He learned how to do business and how to govern in the 1990s, and he was never seriously questioned or convicted for any of the dark stories that he was involved with. And one of the stories was investigated by a Russian politician, Marina Saltykova, in 1992. I remember this time that you could get food or basic products, but you had to pay for them with international currencies. If you needed a cheap food, you had to stay in lines for a very long time, and there was a danger of like a serious problems for the city because of the food shortages. So the mayor's office decided to exchange some earth metals, oil products, and other raw materials for over $100 million and used barter contracts. In return, the city had to receive some food, but the foodstuffs never materialized. And Marina Saltykova, who was a member of the local parliament, investigated these activities and had access to some documents that had even Putin's signature on them. And it's very easy to check that the city was promised to receive food from some companies and never received any of these very important products that people really needed at that time. And Putin was the person to pick these companies. There was no like a public procurement system with competition and due diligence. He just picked some suspicious companies. Some of them belonged to the friends of the mayor. Some of them belonged to the people close to criminal. Some of them belonged to we don't know who. And the city lost these very important oil products and earth materials that could be exported for a price of $100 million, never received any food. Mm-hmm. It happened 30 years ago, and still we can see the same pattern every time with any corruption scandal Putin or his associates were involved in. The same impunity repeats itself all the time.
Carl mentioned that there's a really great video that we published as part of this investigation. You can find it on our website that involves some really fascinating archival footage of the cocaine bust and really does a lot to illuminate this story. And as I mentioned earlier, this first chapter, this first investigation is part of an upcoming series of RFERL stories regarding corruption scandals and scams that swirled around Putin and his associates as he began his political ascent. Carl, talk to us what's coming down the road next.
Yeah, we've got some really interesting stories coming down the pipeline here. They will... they're mostly connected to Putin's External Relations Committee, a very influential committee that Putin headed at the mayor's office. You know, these are corruption stories that are very illustrative of how business was done with his committee during that time. And so I would... for anyone interested in these stories, please keep an eye on our website throughout the week and our Twitter feed, our social media feeds, because we've uncovered details and stories that have seemingly long since been forgotten or never got the scrutiny they deserved in the first place.
And again, as you know, both Andre and Carl have referred to, you can easily draw a direct line from the early days of Putin's political career in St. Petersburg to the state of leadership and the management style that we have seen, that we're seeing today in today's Russia. And I think there's a lot to be learned in looking at those historical parallels. So I look forward to the next chapter of our investigation. So we have a little bit of time remaining, so let's take a few questions from our listeners. Again, you can raise your hand in the hitting the button in Twitter Spaces. You can also send us a direct message, or you can post your question as a reply to the tweet pinned in this Twitter space. We'll try to get through as many questions as we can. Let's see what we get for a question, if any. And there may not be any. Again, if you do have a question, you can raise your hand by hitting the button in the Twitter Spaces. You can also send us a direct message or simply post your question as a reply to the tweet pinned in this Twitter space. While we're waiting for a question to come in, I'll throw a question at Carl. Where's Cherkisov now? He's not somebody you hear about a lot these days. Do we know what happened to him?
Yeah, so he has kind of fallen off the... fallen off the map a bit in recent years. So as we said, he served in the KGB together with Putin, was the top FSB official in St. Petersburg for a long time. Then when Putin moved to the Kremlin, Cherkisov got increasingly appointed to increasingly more powerful posts, including as Russia's top counter-narcotics official in 2003. There's an interesting backstory because I think it was 2007 or 2008, there were some really nasty infighting between security agencies, and Cherkisov ended up publishing a letter saying that the security services must not fall victim to this infighting, and it was seen as a really rare example of a security services insider going public with airing basically their dirty laundry publicly. Mm-hmm. He went on to serve in the Duma in the Russian parliament for years, but he since 2016 he's been out of parliament, and there's I don't really have any credible information as to where he is right now or exactly what he's doing.
Interesting. We have one person who has a question, their hand raised. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Clinton DeVoe here, contributor with the Ottawa Hill Times, as well as City News Radio Network in Canada and Troy Media. So based off of the history of Vladimir Putin sort of leaving government military agencies or security agencies and then becoming, you know, the, I don't want to say elected, but like it becoming a part of the so-called representative government. Do we have any sort of idea who may be a likely successor to Putin based off of some of your understanding of these people that he worked with, you know, at the city level as he eventually became the person that we all know and recognize today? And if we don't have any sort of idea, is that a failure on our part in the West when it comes to our intelligence gathering? Because it seems like the more I hear about what's been happening over the last 3 or 4 months, that there's this fear that a vacuum will be created if and when Putin is removed from office. So I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Andre, you want to handle that one? A question of a successor to Putin and if and when he relinquishes power.
Well, the successor of the Putin is the question of not the near future, I guess. I'm not a political scientist, but I don't see any evidence that he's willing to give any power, and he can leave the presidential office or Kremlin, but he can still be a very influential person, like it happened in Kazakhstan. And speaking about the decision, former Russian President Yeltsin's decision to put Putin on the power, knowing that he had some dirty business in his past, well, I saw how Westerners were very happy with this decision, since he's not a communist and he was not a nationalist, and he never expressed any of these views. And that was enough for the West at that time. And we've seen different Putins over these 20 years, and the first few years of Putin in power, he used to be a reformer, and he relied on some people with liberal and democratic views on how to build an economy. But unfortunately, it was a trap, because while they were building a strong economy in Russia, a very technocratic state, I would say that many services that were built are very useful and people admire it, but all this budget systems and easy taxes and all this infrastructure was used for PR of illiberal views of Russia inside the country and outside the countries, and for the wars, the war in Chechnya, Second Chechen War, the war in Georgia when Russia annexed the South Ossetia, and the war in Ukraine, which we face right now, and we really need to tell about it because it's atrocities happens there. So now we can definitely see it was a mistake, and that the fact that Putin never expressed any of his views that he expresses now was not enough to be so glad that Yeltsin picked someone insane as it was understood back then.
It's a good reminder how Putin was viewed at the very early days of his presidency. He was indeed embraced as this stabilizing figure and wholly welcomed in the West, and that was 22 years ago. The next Russian presidential election is 2024. All bets are off if there's going to be a presidential election, and Who's going to be the successor? There's no real clear indication at this stage in the game. There is another question that's popped up from a listener named Wendy, I believe. Wendy?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, no, I always wanted to work in the State Department, and when Trump took over and he just completely gutted the State Department, it was like a heart, like a knife in my heart. And then he started making some moves on Radio Free Europe, and that was another thing I thought he was doing for Putin, and I just, And so he hasn't been able to reverse the post office problem yet, and I'm just wondering if Biden's been able to kind of reverse whatever damage happened to Radio Free Europe.
That is a question that I'm going to have to punt. This podcast is about Russia and Putin and this new investigation that we've published here. That's not to say, there's plenty to be said. It's all positive, I would say. But I'm going to put that question to the side and keep the discussion more on topic. I see another hand, though I can't tell who the listener is. One second. It's our listener, Clinton, who I believe asked a question previously. Go ahead, Clinton.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot. Clinton DeVoe here again. So follow-up question to my previous one. Is there any sort of understanding at the municipal level in Russia, not necessarily someone who has spoken out against Putin, but is there anyone at the municipal level that appears to have consolidated support from people within their respective cities or towns within Russia that could then use that as a way, as leverage, if you will, to sort of follow the path that Putin did, 30 years ago, that sort of thing?
That's a good question. I have a couple of thoughts that come to mind, but I'm going to kick it to Carl and Andre, see which one of you might have a thought about regional leaders who perhaps have a regional base, an electoral base that could potentially be used to build a larger political movement. Carl Andre, which one of you wants to handle that?
I can go first. I would say that, from the beginning of Putin's reign, he's been extremely wary of regional leaders with, let's say, too much sway and power in their own regions. That one of his first tasks was to basically rein in the regions that were kind of off doing their own thing. You've seen appointments of governors in recent years where people who aren't from the region at all are appointed to lead various regions with which they don't really have much connection at all. The short answer is I don't see anyone with a type of profile that you could easily say, yes, this person is prepared to step right in. And part of that is I would say, Putin's own doing, and which is extremely problematic, is he has created a system that essentially only he is capable of managing. And at some point, his rule will end. And what happens after that is a big question. I would say the one exception with this is Chechnya, where Ramzan Kadyrov has basically been handed the region and told to that he can run it however he wishes, even if it's not in compliance with Russian federal laws. But this is just part of a bargain to essentially keep Chechnya quiet, and in exchange for Kadyrov's basic autonomy there.
Of course,
thank you for answering my question. I appreciate that.
Of course, there are several examples of actual bodyguards, officers with the Federal Protective Service who have been appointed governors by the Kremlin. And then there's the case of the Khabarovsk governor, Sergei Furgal, who had his wings clipped in a dramatic fashion a couple years back by the Kremlin. Any other questions we can take in the remaining time that we have? It doesn't look like it. So with that, I'm going to call it a day and say thank you both to Andrei and Carl for joining us both. And again, I remind people, please go check out the investigation in Russian and English on our websites, and be on the lookout for the next installment of our investigation into the political corruption scandals and scams that that characterized Putin's early years in St. Petersburg. Again, this conversation will also be published, republished as a podcast. You can find it on our website. You can also subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and find many of RFERL's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other similar places. I'm Mike Eckel. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Days of the 90s at Radio Distraction.
Nou, hallo lieve luisteraar. We staan nog steeds in de heerlijke warme zon. Ik heb weer een plekje uit de wind weten te bemachtigen. Het is echt ontzettend lekker hier. En er is, ik ben nog steeds op de Zuidas bij de Klimaatmars Zuidas. Bedankt voor je deelname. Bedankt voor je deelname. Zie ik staan. Ik zie nog meer staan, ik zie een boom staan en ik stond hier net ook en toen stond er iemand anders en die begon tegen mij te praten. Die had een soort milieudefensie uniform aan en die begon een hele interessante vragen te stellen en toen kreeg ik een heel interessant gesprek en toen zei ik van nou, kom, ik wil even op de radio, maar zie ik hem niet. Waar is hij nou gebleven?
Stolen by bandits, I must follow the sound. The triangle tingles and the trumpets play slow. Farewell, Angelina, the sky is on fire and I must go. There's no need for anger, there's no need for blame. There's nothing to prove, everything's still the same. Just the table standing empty by the edge of the sea means farewell, Angelina. The sky is trembling and I must leave. The Jack and the Queen have forsaken the courtyard. 52 gypsies now file past the guards. In the space where the deuce and the ace once ran wild, farewell, Angelina, the sky's changing color, I'll see you in a while. See the cross-eyed pirate sit perched in the sun, shooting tin cans from a sawed-off shotgun. And the neighbors, they clap and they cheer with each blast. But farewell, Angelina, the sky's changing color and I must leave fast. King Kong, little Elvis, on the rooftop they dance. Valentino type tangos while the makeup man's hands shut the eyes of the dead, not to embarrass anyone. But farewell, Angelina, the sky is embarrassed and I must be gone. The machine guns are roaring and the puppets heave rocks, and fiends nail time bombs to the hands of the clocks. Call me any name you like, I will never deny it. But farewell, Angelina, the sky is erupting, I must go where it's quiet.
And then I had a vision.
Ah, Edgar. Ah, Edgar, my dear friend Edgar.
It's been a long time, Roderick. I've ridden many miles. It's been a dull and soundless day for autumn. The leaves have lost their autumn glow, and the clouds seem oppressive with their drifting finery.
I know, my friend. Though I own so much of this land, I find the country insufferable. I deal only in half pleasures.
Speaking of half pleasure, would you care for a tincture of opium?
Nothing would please me more than to smoke with an old friend. I've experienced the hideous dropping of the veil, the bitter lapse into common life, unredeemed dreariness of thought. I have an iciness, a sickening of the heart.
It's true, you don't look well, Roderick, but I am your friend, no matter the occasion or position of the stars. I'm glad you wrote me, but I must admit to concern.
I cannot contain my heart. Edgar, I look to you for solace, for relief from myself. What I have is constitution, a family evil, a nervous affection that must surely pass, but I do have this morbid acuteness of senses. I can eat only the most insipid food, clothes only of the lightest texture. The odor of flowers I find oppressive. My eyes cannot bear even the faintest light. Did you hear that?
I hear. I am listening. Go on.
I shall perish. I will perish in this deplorable folly. I dread the future, not the events, the results. The most trivial event causes the greatest agitation of the soul. I do not fear danger except in its absolute effect, terror. I find I must inevitably abandon life and reason together in my struggles with the demon fear. Perhaps you'll think me superstitious, but the physique of this place, it hovers about me like a great body, some diseased outer shell, some decaying finite skin encasing my morale.
You'd mentioned your sister was ill.
My beloved sister, my sole companion, has had a long continuing illness whose inevitable conclusion seems forsworn. This will leave me the last of the ancient race of ushers.
She looks so much like you.
I love her in a nameless way more than I love myself. Her demise will leave me hopelessly confined to memories and realities of a future so barren as to be stultifying.
What of physicians?
They are baffled. Until today, she refused bed rest, wanting to be present in your honor, but finally she succumbed to the prostrating power of the destroyer. You will probably see her no more.
Sound and music take us to the twin curves of experience. Like brother and sister intertwined, they relieve themselves of bodily contact and dance in a pagan revelry.
I have soiled myself with my designs. I'm ashamed of my brain. The enemy is me, and the executioner terror. Music is a reflection of our inner self. Unfiltered agony touches the wayward string. The wayward brain confuses itself with the self-perceived future and turns inward with loathing and terror. Either by design or thought, we are doomed to know our own end. I have written a lyric.
May I hear it?
It is called The Haunted Palace. In the greenest of our valleys, by good angels tenanted, once a fair and stately palace, snow-white palace, reared its head. Banners yellow, glorious, golden, on its roof did float and flow. This, all this, was in the olden time long ago. In every gentle air that dallied along the rampart, plumed and pallid, a winged odor went away. All wanderers in that happy valley through two luminous windows saw spirits moving musically, the sovereign of the realm serene, a troop of echoes whose sweet duty was but to sing in voices of surpassing beauty the wit and wisdom of the king. But evil things in robes of sorrow assailed the monarch's high estate, and round about his home the glory is but a dim remembered story. Vast forms that move fantastically to a discordant melody, while like a ghastly river a hideous throng rush out forever and laugh, but smile no more, nevermore.
It's cold in here.
I tell you, minerals are sentient things. The gradual yet certain condensation of an atmosphere of their own about the waters and the walls proves this. Thus the silent, yes, importunate and terrible influence which for centuries has molded my family and now me. Excuse me. She is gone. Out, sad light. Roderick has no life. I shall preserve her corpse for a fortnight.
Roderick.
I shall place it in a vault facing the lake. I do not wish to answer to the medical men, nor place her in the exposed burial plot of my family. We shall inter her at the proper date, when I am more fully of a right mind. Her malady was unusual. Please do not question me on this.
I cannot question you.
Then help me now.
One would think you twins.
We are. We have always been sympathetic to each other. Have you seen this? It is her.
It is a whirlwind. You should not, you must not behold this.
Roderick, these appearances which bewilder you are mere electrical phenomena, not uncommon. Or perhaps they have their rank origins in the marshy gases of the lake. Please, let's close this casement, and I will read and you will listen, and together we will pass this terrible night together. What's that? What is that? Don't you hear that?
Not hear it. Yes, I hear it, and I've heard it many minutes. Have I heard it? How, pity me. Miserable wretch. I dared not. Oh, no. I dared not speak. We have put her living in the tomb. I have heard feeble movements in the coffin. I thought I heard. I dared not speak. Oh, God. I have heard footsteps. Do you not hear them? Attention. Do I not distinguish that heavy and horrible beating of her heart? Madman. Madman. I tell you, she now stands without the door.
Ah!